good evening. For those who were here last week, we looked into this issue of Buddha nature a bit. So I'd like to continue with this theme and have some time for discussion. Maybe, was everyone here last week? Were you not?
I wasn't.
So, to review a little bit, there was the story of the three turnings of the wheel of Dharma of Shakyamuni Buddha. So does anyone remember what the first turning of the Dharma wheel is? What?
The Four Noble Truths.
Four Noble Truths, yes. Yeah. Which we sometimes even chant that first turning. We could say that sutra where the Four Noble Truths were taught, and then also many, many other sutras and teachings that came after that, but in that same vein of the Four Noble Truths and phenomena of the world, phenomena of mind that we can pay attention to and work with and deconstruct this apparently existent me into all these different elements. In a way, the Four Noble Truths is a little bit of a deconstruction method. But in this first turning, all those elements that we deconstruct this person into, they, like, really do exist. Earth, wind, fire, and water, for example, those kind of elements, physical elements. And other elements are like, you know, when you break them down into their smallest bits, they are indestructible, elemental, energies or physical matter even. Atoms. These, you know, early Buddhists who were first turning exponents had this kind of theory that the world is made up of atoms. This was like, you know, several centuries BC, long before atoms were discovered by scientists. And as I understand it, there's even, when they get really into the details, there's even there's theories about how there's like, I think even like a central particle with kind of space around it, and maybe even spinning. I'm not sure about the details, but it's pretty close to the modern theory of atoms. But the main point being that those things like really do exist. You know, us, we don't really exist. We're like a kind of conglomeration of all this stuff that we think is a real me, but if we look for the me, we find atoms. But this was only the first turning of the Dharma wheel. And then there's the second turning. Anyone remember that?
Yes.
What was the second turning?
No suffering, no source, no relief, no path.
Ah, yes. Yes, as proclaimed ferociously in the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. And not only is there no Four Noble Truths, but I'm sorry to say, there's not even any atoms. There aren't even any like particles that make anything up. There aren't even all these elements of mind. There aren't even the eye, ears, nose, tongue, body. And there aren't even color, sound, smell, taste, touch, objects of mind. Yeah, all those things that were such wonderful teachings in that first turning were, are basically relinquished because they get in the way of our complete freedom. Sometimes this second turning is said to be the relinquishment or letting go of all fixed reference points, but anything can be a reference point. So atoms, the four great elements, earth, wind, fire, and water, all the different mental elements of mind, they can't be broken down any further. In the end, there's nothing that can even remain in its most basic, fundamental, essentially existent state. That all that is merely the conjurations of mind, mental imputations built on previous mental imputations. And in the end, nothing can actually be found in the end, meaning like ultimate. The ultimate truth is that when we actually try to look for an atom, like in a microscope or whatever, and you can see something there. Obviously, we can see and hear and taste lots of things, but ultimately, in the end, at the bottom of it, we can't find anything. This second turning of the Dharma wheel of the Buddha involves intricate analysis, logical reasoning to convince our very confident mind that actually nothing can really be found. Because we usually go about the day quite confident that things can be found. If we know like the road is kind of a concept, but at least it's made up of these little asphalt molecules and they're supporting us to walk on. We're pretty confident in that, but this second turning is about breaking down that confidence so that actually the road that seems to be supporting us can't be found, asphalt molecules can't be found, and none of it. So that might sound kind of disturbing, like why would we want to undermine our confidence in the fact that we can walk on the road? But this is the great intention of the second turning of the Dharma wheel, is to free us from our fixations on the idea that we're actually walking on a road, because it's slightly disturbing. Now there's of course lots of our other ideas are much more disturbing than that, but the full extent of this second turning is relinquishing all reference points in the end. And personally I feel that one of the greatest gifts of this Buddhist tradition is this the precision and amazing logical infallibility of reasoning and analysis that actually proves that nothing can exist. And this is the project of Nagarjuna, and it's very difficult to understand how his logic is so precise and infallible, because it sounds very strange when you first hear it, but following it through to the end, which takes some work, is quite disturbing to the conceptual mind. But the conceptual mind has to get really involved in doing the analysis to kind of like undo itself. So that's that particular approach. And we can also just say, as the Heart Sutra does, no suffering, no origination, no stopping, no path. But that might not be enough. We might not believe it. It might not like undermine our a way of viewing the world, so we might need to do this analysis. But then we have this third turning of the Dharma wheel. What's that one again? Perfect. That's perfect, and it is perfect. It is sometimes called the perfect nature. And not only does it require, does it not require analytical reasoning to prove, but it can't really be proved by analytical reasoning. So we might think, well, that's a relief that maybe we can skip the second turning. Go right to the third, since it's Buddha nature imminent already. And maybe possible, because anything is possible, especially in the third turning. But generally it's said that to approach this imminent, already perfect Buddha nature, that it's very, very helpful to have this step of basically deconstructing everything into vast unfindability, to relinquish all reference points. Otherwise, we may not appreciate the full extent of Buddha nature. And even more dangerous, we might make Buddha nature into a reference point. And get at least a little hold of it, and use that to maintain our sense of security that at least there's this. There's this thing. If there's nothing else, at least we can have this thing called Buddha nature. But Buddha nature is not a thing. Though I would say it's the supreme security. I think anything that we can think of, like the four great elements and atomic particles and this moment of consciousness, all of that is completely unreliable. We can't really take refuge in that as a place of complete security. But the Buddha nature, which is not something, but also it's not nothing, avails itself to us as a place of complete security and ease. Now, of course, place is not quite the right word, but no word is quite the right word. So, already in speaking about this third turning, it's somewhat problematic, as anything that's said is limits it and creates a potential landing pad for a fixed reference point to settle down and embed its roots there. Sometimes Buddha nature is talked about as a potential for Buddhahood. It's the potential that all sentient beings have or even are, the potential to manifest as complete Buddha. And traditionally what we mean by Buddha, fully manifest Buddha, is when Buddha nature has come to fruition as in this great vehicle tradition of which Zen is a part, the Mahayana, Buddha is no small matter. And hard, again, to say anything about what Buddha is without limiting it, but Buddha is, well, I could say, goes beyond this consciousness which we're aware of everything right now. This consciousness of this mind that's seeing phenomena and aware of what's happening. Buddha is beyond this. This consciousness is not Buddha. So, it's already unimaginable, right? It's not this consciousness. And it's not limited to a body or mind. It's, we could say, if we're speaking of mind, because this is how we approach Buddha, is through mind, but it's more like the nature of mind. It's not mind as we know it, but it's the nature of mind. And the nature of mind, actually, even the nature of this mind right now, the nature of our consciousness right now, is completely empty of any fixed reference points. I mean, if we look for our mind, we might find it's a nice thing to look for, because in a way it's harder to find fixed reference points, maybe harder than anything else. Like, we can look around at anything else or think about any object or anything, and we pretty easily and immediately come upon reference points, you know, aspects of our experience to hold on to and believe in. But we really, as we say, turn the light around, turn the light of awareness around, shine back at mind itself. It's hard to find anything there, or we'd like to find something there. Like, there's that exercise, you know, you can kind of like do this exercise of, you know, you kind of follow your finger, basically. You've kind of pointed things, like, what's that? It's a book. What's that? It's a floor. What's that? It's Johnny. What's that? It's my knee. What's that? It's my stomach. What's that? It's, well, like, you can barely see. It's my chest. Now, like, as the finger moves up, closer and closer, now what's that at the end of the finger? And to, you know, really kind of put some seriousness into this simple, kind of ridiculous exercise, and actually, you know, really, really look. And it helps to point at other things first, you know, things out there, and gradually move it up until this, and what's that? If you, you know, really, without any preconceptions, just ask, it's, we're speechless. You know, not like, oh, it's my face, because if we go with our experience, it's not actually a face, right? That's just my idea of, I know from where you're looking, you look at the end of my finger and you see a face, but I don't see a face. You know, maybe I can kind of see the edge of a nose a little bit, but, you know, if I look like this, I can't even see anything that it's pointing to. And yet, just visually, if we're talking about just what do I see visually, I mean, there's this whole field that's either coming into this or coming out of this. Can't really say. But what's the source that it's coming into or out of? We can't say. it's very hard to find a fixed reference point at the end of the finger, actually. Experientially. So you can try this at home. You can try it now if you'd like.
The first checkpoint.
Yeah, it helps to kind of like, you know, to get into the exercise, to start, you know, following at the end of the finger. What is that? And again, not from any ideas, but like our immediate, like actual direct experience. And base, without analyzing a lot either. Just, you know, that's a thing, that's a thing, that's a thing, that's a thing that I could start to call me, but like, so in that sense, roughly, as a kind of fun little exercise, it seems that it's not a thing, right? This is not a thing. And yet it's not nothing either. And Buddha nature is kind of like that. It's not nothing. That's why there's a third turning. If we stopped with the second turning of the wheel, it would just be, there's no fixed reference points. There's, just like the Heart Sutra says, goes through everything and just says there's no form, feeling, perception, formation, consciousness, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, color, sound, smell, taste, touch, object of mind, or Four Noble Truths, or any of it. And it doesn't, and at the end, you kind of wait for the punchline, well, what is there then? And it just says, therefore, we proclaim the great transcendent mantra that translates to, gone, gone, gone beyond, gone altogether beyond. But then it says, Bodhisvaha. So that's maybe the very end, the third turning appears. Bodhisvaha is awakening Buddha. Hooray. Svaha is an ancient Sanskrit term that means hooray. Or hallelujah. Yippee. Yeah, yippee is good. Mm-hmm. Just as a little aside here to honor Kobin. Occasionally a Kobin reference comes to mind. Kobin Chino, the founder of our Zen Center. I heard that when someone asked him, what's the translation of that mantra of the Heart Sutra? Gate, gate, para gate, para sangate, bodhisvaha. He said something like, falling apart, falling apart. Everything's falling apart. There's nothing you can do about it. Svaha. So, there's nothing you can do about it. And yet, there's said to be great benefit in trusting this Buddha nature. This third turning is kind of in the realm of trust. Whereas the first turning, you could say, is it more about like straightforward understanding. Like we can just contemplate how these Four Noble Truths work and pretty quickly come to some understanding like that actually makes sense. It's quite straightforward. Now, there's infinite depth to all of these teachings, and it's said that the traditional story is that the Buddha, under the Bodhi tree on the night of his great awakening, basically the content of Buddha's enlightenment was the Four Noble Truths, which when I first heard that, I thought, that's so strange. They're so straightforward. Suffering and the origin of suffering and the cessation of suffering and the path that leads to the cessation. It's so beautifully simple. Like, that's the Buddha's great awakening. So I think we have to understand that the depth to which he understood these Four Noble Truths and how they work in a very direct, complete way beyond all fixed reference points was Buddha's awakening. But there's something quite straightforward about the Four Noble Truths which is and the first turning, we could say that Vipassana in America, the Vipassana movement, is a first turning tradition, and it's very popular. There's a Santa Cruz Vipassana Center and many Vipassana centers, and I think partly why it's so popular, and I really appreciate it a lot too, is because it's very straightforward. It lays it all out. Here's some like things you can do, some path you can follow, and some steps, and like this list of four noble truths and 12 factors of dependent arising, and you know, ethical practices you can take up. It's accessible in that way. This second turning of which Zen is a part, in a way, it's surprising that Zen has any popularity at all, because it has, you know, it doesn't really offer any fixed reference points. I mean, it does in a way, because partly because we incorporate some of these Vipassana teachings and bring them up so that people don't run away. If we just said that, like, everything's falling apart, there's nothing you can do about it, people might say, well, great. Where's that Vipassana place again?
We offer them a place to sit down.
Yes. Yes. A place to sit and fall apart. Yeah. Yeah, we offer a very beautiful place to fall apart and, you know, some forms, so like, you know, bowing to the cushion and so on, so that when you really start to fall apart, you don't just like drop onto the floor, because it's like, I'm like, where am I again? And like, oh yeah, yeah, but just bow. Just bow. So we offer like ways to get in and out of the room and stuff like that. It can be helpful. And I think I maybe mentioned this before, but I even have this theory that Zen has a lot of like formality in these kind of forms. I think this is my intuition, is because there's so few other fixed reference points that there has to be a lot of like structure to hold like vast spaciousness and like nothing to hold on to, and to, you know, stay in balance. Because fixed reference points really doesn't mean completely nothing, although it gets, no fixed reference points doesn't mean completely nothing, but it veers dangerously close. Do nothing, and that is another intention of this third Dharma wheel, is for people who fell right off the cliff into nothingness. Now, sometimes emptiness and the teachings of the middle way, or Nagarjuna, sometimes they're spoken of as what you realize in the end is a non-implicative negation. That's a new word to throw out there for fun. Non-implicative negation means like you negate eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, but you don't, there's nothing implied that's, you know, that remains when they're negated. Everything is basically negated logically, analyzed into unfindability, but it's not like then you say, so what's left is dependently arisen mere appearances. Sometimes we do say that kind of thing, because I think, in a way, conventionally speaking, that's what we could say is left. Dependently arising mere appearances of eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and everything that seems to be happening right now is like, it's merely appearances, it's called the conventional truth, and those appearances arise dependent on other conditions. But strictly speaking, like Nagarjuna and his system doesn't actually talk about the conventional truth very much. And I think that's because it's all about relinquishing reference points. So if you start to say, well, let's just say the conventional truth is like this, we'll just grab onto it. We can't help but make, even to say it's just mere appearance, we'll hold to that a little bit. And therefore there's still some ground for grasping and suffering. So it's quite radical, really, this second turning thing, non-implicative negation. But Buddha nature is even more radical, because it's not something and it's not nothing. It's not a non-implicative negation. Buddha nature is not merely a non-implicative negation. It's not just no eyes, no ears, no nose. Even when you go like this, you know, it's not nothing. Words are difficult here, so sometimes we might say nothing. Sometimes that's pretty good. Like, I actually can't say it's any particular thing, so let's say nothing. But if we start to, you know, really get into like capital N nothing, it's too much, because there is clear awareness. And in Buddha, the culmination of Buddha nature manifested completely as Buddha, where there's nothing, well, that's a pretty great thing to like base a whole like religion around. The goal of the religion is to become nothing. That also wouldn't be so popular. Buddha nature might have been actually this third turning. Some people might say that the Buddha actually presented this. I guess I haven't heard it quite as to be a little more popular, but a little bit like that. Like, for some people, it's too much just to hear, like, about non-implicative negation, period. But to hear that actually the goal, the fruition in the Mahayana is not just nothingness. A Buddha is not something, but a Buddha is not nothing. But a Buddha is the infinite compassion. Now that is not nothing, right? Infinite compassion with infinite skillful means to help beings in inconceivable ways, not just like help people that you can see that are suffering, but like beings, invisible beings in like infinite universes and world systems beyond our comprehension, that the Buddha, without moving a particle, without going anywhere, can immediately, completely liberate all these beings in infinite realms simultaneously. So that's not nothing. But it's also not really something, right? Like, well, how does that work? It's completely inconceivable. And the amazing thing is that the source of that Buddha, that fruition of complete Buddhahood, the source that it's based on, its basis, is Buddha nature. And Buddha nature is right here. We could say, for now, say, inseparable from each of us. That's the amazing thing. And if we didn't have, we could say, often it's said, have this nature, we'd even say potential, then it would be impossible to ever realize that. And it maybe sounds impossible anyway to realize that kind of infinite compassion. But the story of the Mahayana is it's completely not impossible. It's completely possible for every sentient being, not just humans, but sentient beings, all have this nature that nothing can stop it from manifesting as complete Buddhahood. That's an amazing teaching that was not taught in the first and second turnings. So, and also the great benefit of, there are many great benefits of trusting this, in a way, unprovable proposition that all beings have Buddhahood. One of them is that it's a cure for discouragement in practice. Discouragement in Buddhist practice. There's this Nagarjuna, is mostly a second turning guy. That was his job in that lifetime. But he has, you know, he throws in a few short third turning treatises as well. And one of them, he says, if this basic element, which in this case is another word of which there's many words for Buddha nature, so let's say if this Buddha nature, if the Buddha nature is actually here, one, and as a sentient being, in a sentient being, one can work hard and find gold in a rock. So this is not to say that it doesn't imply hard work, but one can work hard and find, pure gold encrusted in rock, in one of the classic Buddha nature images. But if it's not here, if this Buddha nature is not here, one can work very hard and one will only get tired. So I think this is a great verse of Nagarjuna, because and a great pointer to how Buddha nature can be a cure for discouragement, because we might feel like all this hard, like when I hear about that kind of Buddha, like, forget it. I don't even care, because it's like so out of my league. It's like, it's just too abstract. I'm just trying to get through the day. But the more faith or trust we have in this Buddha nature, this potential, it's not like we're even going to necessarily realize it anytime soon, complete fruition of Buddha, just that it's possible, and we don't know. And in fact, I think that this is my trust, that we get little tiny glimpses of this Buddha nature. It's not that unusual. Now, they're not glimpses of the complete fruition of Buddhahood, but the Buddha nature that is what becomes Buddha, it's not out of the question at all to just be totally relaxed and very open and just open. And there's a mind that's not limited to our, seemingly limited mind. That just are always here, actually, and it's just obscured. So, like, our experiences are just like clouds all over, and occasionally there's this little window in the cloud, this tiny spot of sky for 1 second, and so, like that. But then, by that little tiny spot, we can kind of infer that there's this huge sky, huge, like, not just like the sky around the earth, but like the whole universe. That's, the other side of those clouds. So, and if that was not the case, and we didn't have access to it, it's not right here with us all the time, then a lot of hard work would just be, it would amount to nothing. Practice work. So some teachers even have said that, if you don't, even if you have some renunciation and some trust in the practice, if you're not really connected or trusting this Buddha nature, that actually eventually we'll just get discouraged and do something else. Well, I think that I've already worked hard here, and I don't see any infinite compassion coming from this person. So I don't know about this Buddha nature thing. I don't really believe that anyway. And then we just stop. But if you trust, the more deeply we trust it, the more impossible it is to get discouraged. And also, for the sake of others, it makes it, it can undermine our tendency to belittle others. We could even say to praise self and belittle others with this Buddha nature. We might think, at first you might think, well, isn't this so cool? I have Buddha nature. I am like the king of the universe. But actually the teaching is that all sentient beings have this Buddha nature equally. Even mice and cockroaches. So it's quite humbling, actually. It's like all sentient beings are equal in this respect. They have equal potential for complete Buddhahood, so that there's no reason to say that person, they look like they're really messed up, they're not anywhere on going towards Buddha. But no, right? Everybody equally. And also, I think it's important to mention, Buddha nature is just the Buddhist, in the Buddhist tradition, it's a little bit sectarian term, right? Because it's like Buddha nature. I mean, I don't know what Christ nature is in Christianity, but maybe something similar. So I think it's not meant to be something exclusive to Buddhism. This is, you don't have to be Buddhist to have Buddha nature. Obviously, right? Cockroaches aren't.
Those crickets are.
Well, they are now. Yeah, that's true. That's true. So, because you say Buddha means awakened, awakened. So it's just awakened nature. So there's a lot more that could be said. A lot more I plan to say, but of course this is how it always goes. But one last remark is about Buddha nature is that we're just talking around it here. That it's not diminished at all by being a sentient being, or it's not diminished when it's inseparable from a sentient being, and it's not improved in the slightest by becoming a fully, infinitely compassionate Buddha. That's one of the most amazing things about it, too. It doesn't change. Buddha nature doesn't change. Now, a fully fruitional Buddha is, we could say that, seems to be different than us sentient beings. But the Buddha nature is identical. I think that's one of the miraculous things about this. And it never changes from beginning to end. Therefore, it's unconstructed, unconditioned. It's not born, doesn't die. It's not impermanent, doesn't come and go. And yet it's not really permanent either, because it's not something. So please feel free to say something, ask anything, or in a little time remaining about Buddha nature.
Yeah. Kind of a model. It's obviously limited, but it's helpful to me to kind of put it all in a moment. It's the ocean. The ocean expresses itself as waves. You can't separate a wave from the ocean. Nothing actually is moving forward with the wave, although it looks like it's moving forward. It's actually just going up and down. Such all things an optical illusion. The wave comes up and it goes away. You can't find the wave anymore. And yet there's always the ocean. in that sense. And so sentience, in a way, is just maybe just our time to be awake. And we make an appearance. But ultimately, we fall into the ocean. And then maybe there's another wave that comes along. Maybe you might think it's the same wave or a reincarnated wave. But in reality, you might say that there couldn't be an ocean without waves.
Yeah, there couldn't be Buddha nature without sentient beings.
So we say Buddha nature like you'd say ocean. But in reality, it's just visible through waves.
Yeah. And I think it, you know, a big discussion is also about what is then the relationship between sentient beings and Buddha nature? Or between the waves and the ocean here. If we start like really looking into what's the relationship there, are they actually the same? This is where I think things can get confusing. Now one tradition says, actually, there's no relationship at all. That's a kind of unusual way to say it. That actually, a sentient being is the obstruction or the obscuration, we could say. A sentient being is the obscuration, kind of covering Buddha nature that prevents this full fruition of Buddhahood. So actually, like in the second turning, all these fixed reference points have to be relinquished. In this third turning, sentient beings have to be relinquished. Like we actually have to, in a way, eliminate a sentient being for Buddha nature to come to fruition as Buddhahood. Now that's a weird way of talking, but that's one relationship between, one might see why one gets into that relationship, because Buddha nature is unconditioned, it's neither permanent nor impermanent, and sentient beings are conditioned and impermanent. So, if we start to get into reasoning there, if we say, how can we have a relationship then between a conditioned thing and an unconditioned non-thing? Yes?
I have a historical question.
Mm-hmm.
You might have addressed this last week, and I'm sorry if it's repetitive, but I know that, the way we relate to these three turnings, these are all teachings that we study.
Yeah.
And we practice.
Yeah.
And sometimes we study the kind of path orientation of the Four Noble Truths, sometimes we study the deep instruction. And sometimes we grapple with this more sort of formless essential.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is right now.
Mm-hmm.
But I also know what it evolved historically.
Yeah.
And so in that way, the first turning, that's like what we would call the more Theravadan, right? And then the second turning was the Nagarjuna and the emptiness.
And Prajnaparamita.
Yeah. Where did the articulation of Buddha nature, referred that Nagarjuna made reference to it, but is there like a school or a teacher who's associated with really starting to talk about that?
Yeah.
And who is that and when was that?
Yeah, they did kind of go chronologically like that. They're based on each other. You know, you couldn't have the later ones without the earlier ones. And so sometimes people say, if from a kind of maybe more religious perspective, we'd say, well, the Buddha actually taught them all these different periods of his life. Some people say the Buddha taught all three, like we do here, but for different people at different times. And I think, and all the schools that teach the third turning always teach the first two also. It's never like an exclusive thing. But vice versa is not the case. First turning people don't always teach the other two. So third is nice and to rotate between them. I even thought we could do like 3-year cycles at Santa Cruz Zen Center. A year each cycle. Anyway, the...
I know Dogen was in that.
Yeah, Dogen has a fascicle called Buddha Nature here. But the sources, the scriptural sources, which all authentic teachings must be based on, according to tradition, is particularly the Mahaparinirvana Sutra, the Mahayana Mahaparinirvana Sutra, teaches Buddha nature, which is, these are ones that we have in English translation, not very popular, but huge, long sutra. That's one of the main sources. Also the Srimala Devi Sutra, the lion's roar of Queen Srimala, doesn't get so extensively into it, but it's known as one of the classic sources taught by a queen, a woman, third turning lion roarer. These are Mahayana sutras. Mahayana sutras. Yeah, so we'd say, you know, historically these sutras developed after Prajnaparamita sutras, you know. So we have historically, and then religiously we'd say, well, they were all taught by the Buddha who only lived for 80 years. And we have the Sandhya Rinpoche and the Sutra, which we have studied here, and that's one of the main sources where the three turnings of the Dharma wheel are mentioned in that sutra. But it doesn't explicitly talk about Buddha nature. It says the third turning, in that case, is like the definitive teaching that makes clear distinctions between definitive and provisional teachings. And it kind of implies, as you might recall, the thoroughly established nature of all phenomena. Do you remember that part? That later tradition will start to equate that thoroughly established, and just by the name thoroughly established gives a little hint towards the evolution of that into Buddha nature. It gets equated with Buddha nature. A main one for the Zen tradition is the Lankavatara Sutra. Lankavatara Sutra teaches these three turnings and the three characteristics, and it gets into, also called Tathagata Garbha. So also we have the Tathagata Garbha Sutra. So there's these sutra teachings, and then there's like Asanga, the founder of Yogacara tradition. Also, he's the main Indian treatise on Buddha nature. So it's also connected with Yogacara and mind only. It's a little kind of derivation off of that. But quite dynamic, and how it connects to the second turning and all this whole Mahayana thing going on there is very interesting, I think, actually. And all the creativity that came around, how to talk about these kinds of things. Anyway, I'll just, since it's time to stop, just close with a Dogen quote. So this is Dogen's actually longest Shobo Genzo fascicle called Busho, or Buddha Nature. And he starts by quoting the Parinirvana Sutra, which says, "All sentient beings without exception have Buddha nature. The Tathagata abides forever without change." But then he goes wild with that, as usual. Buddha nature should not be confused with a self of the person. Although awakened beings may be Buddhas, Buddha nature itself is neither enlightenment nor awakening. Much less is the awakening used in referring to Buddhas as awakened beings the awakening such people indicate with their various mistaken views. It's not the movement or the stillness of wind and fire. The face of a Buddha, the face of an ancestor, that and nothing else is awakening. With Buddha and nature, if you penetrate one, you penetrate the other. Buddha is nature, nature is Buddha. Buddha nature is always entire being, because entire being is Buddha nature. Entire being is not an infinite number of miscellaneous fragments, nor is it like a single undifferentiated steel rod. It's a raised fist, so it's neither large nor small. Inasmuch as entire being is Buddha nature, it cannot be compared to a Buddhist sage. It cannot be compared to Buddha nature itself.
So what blew my mind when I read this week was, is that when you say Buddha nature as two words, Buddha nature, it implies sentience. And at some point, there is no Buddha has no Buddha nature. There's no way of separating those two terms. It just collapses. There's no Buddha. Buddha has no Buddha nature.
Buddha has no Buddha nature. Buddha nature has no Buddha. May all living beings realize the inseparability of complete emptiness free from all reference points and clear, open clarity, luminosity shining everywhere, inconceivably inseparable, inconceivably inseparable, inconceivably inseparable. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.